Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, David Margalek. He's a former reporter and columnist on legal affairs for the New York Times, and his latest book is When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy, published in November 2025 by Schocken Books. I spoke with him via Zoom about how he chose the pioneering television comedian as his most recent subject.
Well, I was asked to write, to contribute to this Jewish book series. And I had my background was in law and legal coverage. And so my first impulse was to write about Brandeis or Frankfurter or one of those guys. And I thought there's really no reason I can't write about somebody who's going to make me laugh. Particularly in the Jewish context, there aren't always those people don't jump readily to mind. I mean, there are lots of historic figures, you know, whose stories are sad. And I thought I wanted to enter a happier realm. So I thought of comedy. Groucho Marx was taken already. And I had had a glancing encounter with Sid Caesar at this testimonial dinner for him several years earlier. Mm-hmm. And it left me with a gnawing question. I mean, he was this decrepit old man who seemed faltering and inarticulate in a way. And I wondered what all the fuss was about. Mm. And even when that evening was over and I had heard Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Larry Gelbart sing his praises, it was hard to describe what they were talking about, because you certainly couldn't see that in the man that was standing before us all in the ballroom of the Pierre Hotel that night. My journalist instinct was that there was a good story here for two different reasons: to explain why he was so great and important, and then to explain why he had disappeared.
Right.
You know, I mean, there was the way up and the way down, and they were both interesting questions to me. Mm-hmm. And it was also, frankly, it was an excuse to talk to him and to Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks and Woody Allen and all of these people.
Yes.
I mean, what journalist wouldn't avail himself of the chance to do that? And
right.
It turned out that not only were these people relevant to my story, but they were available. And they were available not because of me. They worshipped Sid Caesar, and they wanted to tell his story, and they wanted to acknowledge their debt to him. That was a privilege, too, to listen to these guys.
Right, right. Which is why we do journalism. But biography is often different because people are deceased. And you have written books about deceased people, too. So I'm just curious. And this is also a fabulous moment in time in pop culture. And, you know, you were probably not a kid watching Sid Caesar the way our parents were, young people watching Sid Caesar. So can you talk a little bit about that? Just sort of stepping back into history and reconstructing history, not just through Sid Caesar, but just this really seminal moment in the birth of television.
Well, in a way, I mean, I'm an unlikely historian of television because we weren't really allowed to watch it when I was growing up. I grew up in one of those homes. It wasn't one of the homes that was without a television still. I mean, my parents did break down and buy one, but they weren't watching it a lot. And it was, you know, it was sort of, I used to watch it in fear that my father would come down the stairs, you know, and get all upset about my watch.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right that, you know, I was born in 1952. That was the heyday of Sid Caesar, and which continued really until 57 or 58 or 59.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, when I came into consciousness, Sid was really fading away.
Right.
But and so I felt as if the era that Caesar was in, even though he really wasn't a part of my consciousness for the initial part of it, you know, I related to the birth of television, and television was still sort of provisional in a way when I was growing up. And you know, the very fact that my father didn't want me to watch it, television was on probation. So I didn't feel as if I was com that the Caesar era was completely alien to me, even though it didn't really include Sid Caesar, and I had to reconstruct Caesar's part in it. You know, I mean, the 1950s were when I came of age, and that was the era of Sid Caesar. So in that way, it wasn't that much of a stretch for me.
Yeah, no, I see. I see. But let's talk about what you did do to reconstruct the person and as well as the time, from the research that you did do. So you did talk to all of these incredible people, and the Paley Center in New York was a incredible is an, a recredi incredible repository of archives. But how did you go about it besides doing what we all do, which is cast that wide net? How walk us through how that worked.
Well, you know, the principal task, Lisa, was to track down the TV shows, right? I mean, that was what the story was really about. And in fact, I mean, now my book is being described as a biography. I never really conceived of it as a biography. I thought it was really the story of the television work that he did. And in fact, it's quite a lopsided, if it's a biography, it's quite a lopsided one. It's malapportioned because most of it concerns 10 years of his life. All right. And then there's the 20% before he's on TV, you know, and describing his origins and growing up and being in the service and pre-TV, you know, his appearances on Broadway and that kind of thing, his early experience as a musician. The next 55%, you know, or 60% is his television work, which really effectively ended in the early 1960s. And then you have this 50-year period when he disappears, and then he comes back as a shell of his former self. And you have to go through that very, very quickly in a way, because while it's dramatic, it's less interesting in a way, and it's less important to his contributions. I mean, the contributions were all in those early years when he was the biggest thing on television and the most original force in television. And so for that, my first task was to go back and watch the shows. And as you say, the Paley Center is the great repository in New York is the great repository that had probably 60 or 70% of the shows. There's no place that has them all. And then other shows are at the Library of Congress, and still more are in Caesar's collection. Caesar had two seminal shows, Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour. And most of Your Show of Shows is at the Paley Center. Caesar's Hour is spottier because there was only one copy of the Caesar's Hour tapes, and those were made by Sid Caesar. And that was Sid Caesar's own show. So that was in that those shows were in his collection, and a lot of them were at UCLA and nowhere else. So that was my first assignment, was to track down the shows. Contrary to popular belief, most of them do exist, although Caesar cut them up some, and there are segments of them that are missing, and every once in a while a sketch surfaces even on YouTube that I've never seen. But I probably watched 85 or 90% of the shows. That was the first task. It's a little, you know, a 90-minute show for 4.5 years, plus an hour show for 4 more years. That's an intimidating amount to watch. But in fact, it's a little bit more simple than that, because each of these shows, and particularly Your Show of Shows, was not all comedy. You know, it was a variety show, and there was a lot of opera singing and dancing and dance numbers and stuff like that. My finger was on fast forward a lot for some of these shows. The incredible pressure, the pressure that ate Sid Caesar alive, of doing a live show first for an hour and then for 90 minutes, you know, every week, week after week after week, it makes it more understandable that there was a lot of repetition on the show. They redid or repackaged a lot of the sketches, and a lot of them were really redundant, and so I could skip some of them. And so in other words, watching all these hours of TV, it was a little less intimidating than it might have been. And then, after that, to round out my long answer to your question, I had to go into the clippings. I had to go into the newspaper coverage of the time. And that's easier, of course, than it used to be because of digitization and all of that. And you have to read the New York papers, all the important New York papers. You have to get beyond the New York Times, which is a hard lesson for a lot of people to learn. But in many ways, the New York Times was not the most important paper covering Sid Caesar. And you have to read the Hearst papers. You got to read the Journal American. You have to read the New York Post. You have to read some of the Herald Tribune. They're all important. You have to read the major papers around the country because they all had their television writers. And you have to follow how Caesar spread like television across the country from the Northeast, where he was originally confined to. As television spread, everybody had the experience sequentially of experiencing him, watching him for the first time. So, you got to read the Des Moines Register in order to, read the Register reporter saying there's this guy named Sid Caesar and everybody in the East is talking about him. So Caesar sort of spilled across the country, and you have to follow that. And then, you got to read the magazines and the industry papers. You have to read Variety. You have to read Billboard. You have to read Look and Life magazines. You have to read all the journalism of the time. Then you have to, then you have, because Caesar disappeared to such a degree, you need to speak to the people who watched him as kids and were influenced by him as kids. People like Richard Lewis, Conan O'Brien, or Billy Crystal, the comedy nerds, the young fogies who discovered this old timer in a way, who was and you and watched them, and were influenced by him and inspired by him. I mean, Billy Crystal said that, Sid Caesar inspired him to be a comedian, and Conan said the same thing. And Carol Burnett emulated him, and Johnny Carson emulated him. And then, you need to trace the vast influence he had through all of the disciples. So you got to speak to the disciples too.
And yet you're saying that you don't see this as a biography. Is that because you consider a biography to be less interesting than the book that you wound up writing? Because biography has a weird rap. A lot of people don't understand that it's not always a cradle to grave.
Yeah, well, maybe I should just listen to the people who are calling it a biography, because it really serves the same purpose. It's just that, when Caesar, thanks to his alcoholism and his pill popping, was really out of commission for 20 years, you can get through that. You tell a few vivid stories about what he seemed like. How Dick Cavett would interview him and feed him softball questions because he knew that his brain was gone, or in mothballs in a way. There's a limit to how often you have to repeat the horror stories of what Sid Caesar was reduced to, and the helping hand that everybody who admired him extended to him because they wanted to prop him back up. You can, I don't, I'm not, I don't think there's anything pejorative about the term biography. And I'm happy to call my book a, I don't care what people call it, as long as they take it seriously. They can label it any way they want. And I do cover him from cradle to grave. It's just apportioned differently.
Well, and that's the artistry, and that's what you've obviously achieved here. And what makes it even more fascinating is that you weren't coming into it as an acolyte. You were coming into it just purely out of curiosity about this person you happen to have seen. If we could just talk for a minute about that. So, given that you were coming at it the way you were, not as a rabid Caesar TV nut. How did it's I think you've described how it informed how you constructed this book, but maybe you could step back a little bit more and say how you took all this vast material, all this viewing that you did, and inputs. And that's what everybody always asks us as biographers is how did you know you were ready to write, and how did you get through the process of writing?
Well, I think that the first thing that I had to do was convince myself that he was as great as everybody said he was.
Hmm.
I didn't know that he was that great.
Hmm.
And I have to say that throughout it all, I had to keep reminding myself that he was great. I needed regular reminders of that. And I mean, the sheer body of his greatness, I was slow to assemble in a way. All right. Because his greatness was both very regular, but it was also, in a way, very sporadic. You had to find the great sketches, all right? Because there was a lot of mediocrity and repetition embedded in his record. So, when my friend Julian Schlossberg put together an anthology of Caesar's great stuff in 1972, like 12 years after Caesar disappeared, he did something called 10 from Your Show of Shows, which was released theatrically. It wasn't as, everybody thought, he was going to do the 10 greatest sketches from Your Show of Shows, and there would be another 10 that he, and then another 10 after that, and there would be 10 from Your Show of Shows, Roman numerals 1, 2, 3, and 4. And you really couldn't have done that. He could have done more of them, but there wasn't a limitless supply of them, right? I mean, Caesar had there were there you know Caesar had like particular characters. He played the German professor, all right, the German professor with the beat up hat and sloppy clothes, who's an authority on everything, all right. This was a chance for Caesar to use his German double talk, his ability to sound like a German the way that he would sound like an Italian or a Frenchman or a Russian or anything like that. And there, this was a role that he played every second or third week on Your Show of Shows. And the sketches were written primarily by Mel Brooks. So it's a vast treasure trove of early Mel Brooks. It come almost completely untapped. And it's very funny. And and there is Brooks, week after week, instance after instance. But there's only so much. I mean, if you're a student of all of this, I enjoyed it all, but you don't have to watch it all to get an idea. A little goes a long way. And so that sort of made the process of sifting through this simpler. And it made the challenge of finding Sid's great, great sketches and what the body of his work that you could put together, and that therein lay the case for his greatness. But it wasn't always self-evident to me, and I needed regular reminding of it. And his work evolved over the years. In a way, his genius was more on display early on, okay, when his skills were fresher and rawer, and he was in better shape, and he was really dazzling. Early on, he would do these incredible soliloquies where, he would play every role in a movie. And Larry Gelbart said his talent was just extraplanetary, was the term that he used. There'd never been anyone like him. And it translated beautifully into television because it had a kind of intimacy that could be captured on a screen rather than in a big theater. And so the early Caesar is dazzling in that way. The later Caesar, the Caesar of the famous writer's room, not the early Caesar where the writer's room was kind of skeletal, but the Caesar of Caesar's Hour and Not Your Show of Shows, the writing was much more sophisticated. The sketches were much more ambitious. They're really brilliant, and they don't lend themselves to anthologizing because some of them are 15 or 20 minutes long. There's one, I mean, Caesar did these incredible takeoffs of silent movies. And he would reconstruct a silent movie with great reverence for the technique of silent comedy. And it's just it knocks you out. It's so and they were doing it on live TV, which is just amazing. There was absolutely no room for screwing up. But Caesar was impaired by this point. He'd been drinking a lot and he'd been taking tranquilizers, and you can hear him slurring his speech. So the comedy is still brilliant, but the brilliance lies often as much in the writing as in the performances.
And just to go back, I mean, to the methodology here, hearing you talk, it's so different than if you were writing a literary biography where you were reading someone's works or even their notes or diaries or letters. Here you are actually seeing this person evolve before your very eyes. And that, I mean, it's ineffable. I mean, you can't really describe, but I
Oh yeah, and you know what's interesting about it, Lisa, and it's one of these things that I've encountered several. I'm often interested in things that people haven't written about before, and haven't analyzed before. And you know, you and I both know that as journalists, you know, our first refuge is to find people who know all about something to make us look good, and you know, you just plug into the people who've done the work already. But in a lot of instances, people had not done this work. They hadn't watched these things and analyzed them. And I had to reach back and come up with my own conclusions about them in a way that I hadn't always done as a daily newspaper reporter. It was harder work for me. I had to find my own voice in a way more. I couldn't hide behind the expertise of others. I had to stick my neck out more. And I needed to be more attentive and observant some ways than I had been before. You know, I was writing something that hadn't been analyzed, that there weren't experts to turn to, and in a larger format where people would want more of me than they would demand in a 900-word story.
Thank you for perfectly articulating why many of us from journalism turn to writing books. That's exactly why, and that's
Because
exactly the challenge.
we're more ambitious and we want a larger canvas to paint on, but not everybody can make that transition. You know, lots of people can't. I mean, I know some great journalists who haven't done it, you know, and I don't think any the less of them, but you know, that's, you know, they stick within a different format, you know, and I felt the longer I was in the business, the more ambitious I needed to be. And, you know, I mean, when I first got into newspaper work, I would sometimes sit by my terminal and, you know, and keep, you know, even for a mediocre story, I would keep my story in the mor in that morning's paper at my side just to look at my name, just to look at the name, my byline in print, and feel, you know, on top of the world. And you know, after a while, the byline and even the story don't matter so much. You realize that you want to do stuff that's going to last. And you know, I mean, you can do lots of things that last in daily journalism, but you know, sometimes it's easier to do if you have a larger format to work with. And that, you know, oddly, and I never thought about it until this minute, but that was Caesar's dilemma. I mean, there are interesting passages in the book where, you know, where Mel Brooks tries to convince Sid Caesar to go to Hollywood. And, you know, Mel Brooks sort of analogized television to daily journalism. You know, he didn't use the wrapping fish image, but he said television is made on cellophane and film is made on film. And cellophane is not going to last. And you need to do something. You are Charlie Chaplin. You are Buster Keaton. You're Harold Lloyd. But you're not going to last unless you go to Hollywood. And Sid didn't go to Hollywood until much later and much more, you know, casual, even much more incidentally in a way. He never made a great film. And so, in that sense, Mel's prophecy was borne out that, you know, and Caesar's stuff was never came to be known. I mean, the reason that Caesar disappeared was that his stuff was preserved on kinescopes rather than on film like Lucille Ball or The Honeymooners. Caesar's stuff is so great. that it holds up. It could be done in hieroglyphics, and it would hold up. It wouldn't make any difference because it's so great. But it didn't lend itself to syndication in later television. So the works until YouTube came along, really, the works that we're talking about had largely disappeared. And some of the stuff that I saw, I mean, a lot of it is on YouTube now, and you can watch a lot of the best sketches. And my book editor, John Siegel, reminded me of that you don't have to describe these sketches at great length because people can push the button and watch them now on YouTube. But not all of them are on YouTube, and some of them have not been seen in 70 years. One of the things that we alluded to before was about television changing, and when television spread to the sticks, tastes changed. And Sid was sort of highfalutin all of a sudden, too sophisticated for people in the sticks. And people in the sticks felt that Sid was kind of condescending, was talking down to them. I mean, spoofs of famous operas and The Bicycle Thief and German movies and all of that sort of thing. Caesar with Japanese movies, Caesar was talking a different language. They wanted to watch Lawrence Welk, who was on opposite Caesar and knocked Caesar off the air. And that's that great moment in the story that a writer dies for, really, that crystallizes that it perfectly illustrates the point that he's trying to make, A, and B, no one now knows it. Because no one knows really the history of early television is underreported, and what television looked like when it first came on, and how people adapted to it, and how fancy people wouldn't buy televisions, and the first reaction to television in Des Moines and Ogden, Utah, and all these places that I write about, the seismic impact that it had. Anyway, Caesar spoofed Lawrence Welk. Brutally, and uncharacteristically, Caesar was a gentle comedian, really. He didn't go after people, but he went after Lawrence Welk in these sketches that no one's seen for 70 years, but they're out there, and I'm trying to bring them back. And it was all in a losing cause because Lawrence Welk would knock them off the air.
That's David Margalik, author of When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. We spoke via Zoom on December 17th, 2025. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. Thanks for listening to Bio.
To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.